This episode is brought to you by Council for a Livable World. Let's be honest, few people really want to spend their days thinking about nuclear war. It is not fun to think about. Luckily for us at Pod Save the World, our friends at Council for a Livable World work on avoiding it every day. For more than 60 years, Council for a Livable World has made improving U.S. nuclear policy its mission. They've helped elect more than 400 members of Congress who support policy that makes sense, keep us safe, and doesn't waste our tax dollars. They've consistently pushed Congress to do its job by asking government officials and industry officials tough questions on nuclear weapons, missile defense, and other national security and foreign policy topics. And with the help of people like you, Council for a Livable World, they've endorsed candidates in advocacy on Capitol Hill and have helped lead to treaties and agreements that reduce the global nuclear stockpile from more than 70,000 at the height of the Cold War to about 12,000 nukes today. That's incredible progress, but their work is far from over. Nuclear risks are rising again. You can help Council for a Livable World finish the job through quick and easy actions by going to livableworld.org/crooked. That's livableworld.org/crooked.
If you feel like people on the other side of the political divide are from Mars, Left, Right, and Center helps you understand where they're coming from. I'm David Green. We invite people from the left and right to our show each week. We unpack our political differences, not to smooth them over, but to bring clarity to what's really at stake. I'm excited to bring you our approach of discussing divisive issues respectfully. You can listen to Left, Right, and Center every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
And we are live from CrookedCon. This is very cool. Thank you all for being here. It has been a year since Donald Trump was elected. Kind of feels like a lifetime. And now seems like as good a time as ever to assess his foreign policy record, how Democrats should talk about it. That wasn't supposed to be a joke. And what the Democratic Party's foreign policy platform and message should be going forward. So we're going to get all that done in an hour, I guess.
Yeah, no problem.
We're also going to welcome some great guests in a bit. Congressman Ro Khanna from California. And Congresswoman Yasmin Ansari from Connecticut, or from Arizona. Why did I write Connecticut? My brain is on Arizona. But before we do that, Ben, I just want to shoot the shit for a minute, like we do on the show. Tom Brady announced that he cloned his dog. The story is actually so much worse, Ben. It turns out he disclosed that he cloned his dog as part of an announcement of an investment into a biotech company.
You know who else cloned their dog?
Who?
Javier Milei of Argentina. Oh, yeah.
That's right.
With some of that $20 billion bailout money that we gave
him. Yeah. Up to $40 billion. Also, did you see that Viktor Orban is in Washington today?
I know. Just in time for CrookedCon. A surprise guest, everybody. Okay.
Last night, we brought out Obama.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen.
Viktor! That would be so funny. Okay, let's get to the show. So we're going to take a little stroll down memory lane. We're going to see if Donald Trump is living up to the campaign promises around foreign policy. The first one is that he will be the peace president. So in Trump's inauguration speech, he said, "We will measure our success not only by the battles we win, but also by the wars that we end, and perhaps most importantly, the wars we never get into. My proudest legacy will be that of a peacemaker and a unifier," Ben. So we're going to dig into this. We're going to get to Ukraine separately because it's just its own thing. I do think it's just worth saying, I'm not mad that Trump came in like excited to make peace. You know, he could have come in all Dick Cheney, like horny for regime change, you know?
Except at the same time, there's like what Trump says and then what Trump does.
Well,
and there's usually a fairly cavernous gap that we can talk about, because in the same speech, he also exalted himself as a peacemaker and said that he was going to take back the Panama Canal. So right from the beginning, there was a little bit of a, you know, whiplash hypocrisy thing going on.
Yeah, devil's in the details, I guess. Okay, so just a few examples. So you and I have talked many times about the fact that we give Trump credit for putting real pressure on Bibi Netanyahu to get a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. That's something we wish Joe Biden had done, we think he could have done, and Biden's refusal to pressure
Netanyahu led to lasting damage for the people in Gaza, for the Democratic Party, for President Biden's political standing, and it's just, I think, a real stain that Democrats are digging out of. But on the flip side, Trump wants credit for ending the war between Israel and Iran, when in reality, he had diplomatic talks going with Iran, and then he bombed them. And then he's threatening to bomb them again. And so that's not very Nobel Prize-y, I don't think.
Yeah. And the other problem with this is all these, a lot of these, you know, quote unquote peace deals are like very thin smoke screens, right? Because there's not really a true ceasefire even in Gaza,
right?
We've seen Israel go back in. We don't know what the Iranians are doing with their nuclear program and what that might lead to in the future. And so a lot of these things, I mean, look, the obvious point is that he bombed Iran and then said he ended the war that he started. That's one way to go about ending wars, I suppose.
Yeah.
But also, like, the underlying conflicts are actually festering and in some ways getting worse while he just kind of parachutes in for photo ops.
Yeah. And, you know, so that's one of the many factual problems with this claim that he ended 8 or 10 wars or 15 wars or whatever it is at this point. And then as we speak, the administration is blowing up boats in the Caribbean and they're threatening regime change in Venezuela. He's threatening to invade Nigeria. He released a random standalone video about that the other day. The New York Times had a report 2 days ago about the military options that have been developed by, you know, the joint staff for Trump. I remember I emailed Helene Cooper, who's a great reporter at the New York Times, who Ben and I know very well, and she's been like, I literally can't believe I just read your story about the actual, like, kind of Goldilocks-style light, medium, hard.
Nigerian invasion plan?
Yes. Yeah. Nigerian invasion plan. And then, you know, so I don't know, those things probably won't be popular in Oslo either. But I don't know, how are you assessing this broader set of claims that he is the peace president so far?
I think there's like two things I'd highlight. One is that the 8 wars that he gives himself credit for ending, which is a ridiculous list if you look at it, right? It includes Serbia and Kosovo, which, you know, you have to be as old as I am to remember when that war actually ended.
Yeah. Was Trump president in 1990?
Yeah, in the 90s? Yeah, no. But I think he, like, Azerbaijan and Armenia, which had already ended, and we could go down the list, but I think that he likes to present himself in that way and repeat it so much. And I'm sure if you watch Fox, you think, well, this is great. This guy's flying around the world. I haven't heard of most of these countries, but it seems like it's great he's ending these conflicts. While at the same time, what he's actually doing is he's expanding the forever war, right? He's brought the forever war actually here, literally to Washington, D.C., right? And I think what you have to connect the dots between is the fact that he's turning the military, trying to turn the military into an extension of his kind of personal interests, whether they're deploying in U.S. cities, whether they're blowing up boats in the Caribbean, whether they might be used for a regime change operation in Venezuela, whether he gets somebody whispering in his ear about Nigeria and suddenly we've got a special ops going there. The dangerous thing that I see that I think we all need to be concerned about and aware of is if he can essentially completely ignore Congress, completely ignore the law domestically and internationally, and turn the military into something that just serves his interests, that's where shit gets real.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, not that it's not already real in a lot of other ways, but that's the no amount of celebration of the Armenia-Azerbaijan corridor named after Donald Trump can obscure the fact that he's illegally killing people in the Caribbean right now.
Yeah, as we speak. Clap for that. You left out my favorite example of a war he claims to have ended is the war between Egypt and Ethiopia, which was literally never fought. Like, they have an ongoing diplomatic...
That's how effective he is.
Yeah. Yeah. He's that good. Yeah. Donald Trump doesn't have a PhD in foreign affairs. He's just that good. All right. So let's talk about Ukraine. The most glaring and obvious foreign policy failure was he has not ended the war in Ukraine in 24 hours, like he said. The war is still raging for Ukrainians. I think life is as bad, if not worse, as it was the day he was elected. I don't think that voters really penalize him for the time frame. I think they kind of lump it into like the bucket of Trump bullshit and hyperbole. But I think it's worth unpacking why being anti-support for Ukraine was a potent campaign message and then thinking about how Democrats could talk about it differently. So what you'd hear from Trump was kind of like a couple parts. It was one, stop sending billions of dollars to Ukraine, spend them here in America, like a timeless.
The oldest, yeah. John Kerry, let's stop opening firehouses in Baghdad and
open them here. I was literally going to say that.
Sorry, you have to be a little older to get that joke.
Yeah, yeah. Two, don't defend Ukraine's border when we can't control our own. I think that was like especially potent in the later Biden years. And then three, Trump would argue that by supporting Ukraine, Biden was going to start a direct conflict with Russia, leading to World War III. And that was something you actually heard a lot from like the Joe Rogan crowd. Like it was sort of an article of faith, especially when the Biden administration allowed the Ukrainians to use what are called attack-em missiles to hit targets within Russia itself. And so like when you assess the result, obviously the war's not over. I guess Trump sort of tried, like he talks to Putin now, which Biden didn't. Like Biden isolated the Russians and Putin for a good reason, as did the rest of the world. Trump is now having conversations, including the Alaska summit, but they haven't accomplished anything. And then every once in a while, Trump flips out and threatens sanctions or threatens to give the Ukrainians Tomahawk missiles that can hit Moscow. Or there was this insane Truth Social post the other day where Trump told Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of War, not defense, to prepare to restart testing nuclear weapons. So I think the question, Ben, is like, what do we do with this failure? How do we turn it back on Trump and make the case that actually his failure in Ukraine has made us less safe?
I think the thing about the war in Ukraine that is not well understood is, first of all, it has actually gotten much worse since Trump took office. There's been a significant escalation in Russian attacks on Ukrainian civilians, significant attacks against Ukrainian infrastructure. Every time, you know, I mean, it's not subtle what Putin does. Like, they were ramping up their attacks right around the Alaska summit. Like, the message from Putin to the world is, like, I own this guy, I can do whatever I want, and he'll still roll out the red carpet for me in Alaska, right? So the first point is that this is not only failed, it's made things worse. The second point is, I think where, and I'm on this one, I'm sympathetic to the challenge that the Biden team was facing. But I do think one thing that was missing was a sense that the goal actually is to end the war,
yeah.
Right? Like, it's important to say, don't look like, you know, you want to be in this conflict. The purpose of the support for the Ukrainians is to get to a solution that is just for the Ukrainians, you know?
I just want to say, that's a really important point, because you would hear from a lot of people, Republican and Democrat, behind closed doors, like foreign policy experts who were like, it's pretty good that we're chewing up the Russian military, you know? They're getting decimated. And it was a really, like, kind of bloodless, inhumane way to talk about a horrifying conflict.
That's right. And so what you would actually want is, like, the objective is to end this war, but to end it on terms that are acceptable to the Ukrainians. And that requires marshaling allies, which is something Trump can't do. I mean, instead of coordinating before that Alaska summit, it went so catastrophically that all the Europeans had to fly here the next day to coordinate post facto to make sure that he didn't give away basically all of Ukraine to Putin, right? And so what it requires, the objective being to end the war, but to end it on terms in which all the allies can get together, give the Ukrainians acceptable security guarantees. Probably not going to get everything back, obviously, but there is a way that this can end that is good for the Ukrainians. The one thing I would also say is, the Democrats, you know, to connect the two conversations we've had, we should be the party for ending forever wars.
Yes.
We should be the party that is for dismantling the forever war infrastructure, which includes, what do you think the equipment is that ICE is wearing, right? That is stuff that was used in Iraq and Afghanistan, right? And then third, on this World War III point, I don't know, who makes you guys a little more worried about World War III? The, like, aging narcissist in the Oval Office who's talking about testing nuclear weapons, renaming the Department of War? Do you feel comfortable with the collection of aging autocrats that are running the nuclear superpowers in the world today? I don't. And so I think the Democrats need to reclaim this space. Sometimes we're so worried about being called weak, or we're so worried about, you know, what, I don't know, some hawkish op-ed writer that nobody listens to anymore is going to say about us, that we don't say we want to end wars, we want to end forever wars, we don't want World War III, we're for diplomacy, we're for alliances, and that's actually where most Americans are.
Who's the guy at the Times that hates us? What's his name?
I didn't want to name it.
Okay. Yes, this is like top two priorities for Democrats, like be the anti-war party. Trump stole that mantle from us, we got to get it back. One of the areas of Trump's foreign policy that has surprised me the most is how flailing and unfocused their approach to China has been. Because when Trump took office, like the thing that all the smart people, the very serious people in title case agreed on in Washington was that China was the real threat and we needed to focus on it. And Trump ran hard on China. He was constantly talking about China. Project 2025 included language about making China, quote, the top priority for U.S. defense planning. But in practice, the policy has just been a mess. So you start with the tariffs. The tariffs go up. The tariffs come down. They don't do anything. Like, we give them AI chips. They give us, they buy our beans. you're an AI guy. Is that a good trade?
Nope.
Soybeans for AI chips. And the only problem that the tariffs are solving are the ones created by the tariffs in the first place. And then, again, on AI, like, we're loosening these restrictions on NVIDIA chips that are incredibly powerful, influential. And Joe Biden had put real restrictions that would prevent China from winning this AI race, and Trump has just sort of erased that. The other part of it that is surprising to me is instead of building coalitions to work with to combat China, we are tariffing them. The Japanese, the South Koreans, the Vietnamese, like insulting them, slapping their leaders around for no reason, humiliating them, and then again cozying up to like the Kim Jong-uns of the world. Instead of deploying the U.S. Navy to the South China Sea, he has sent something like 10 to 15% of all U.S. naval assets to South and Central America to threaten Maduro with regime change. And then fentanyl is chemicals from China that go to Mexico where they get assembled and then trafficked into the U.S. But instead of managing that, we are blowing up these boats off the coast of Venezuela, off the coast of Colombia and Ecuador that don't even have fentanyl in them. They're filled with cocaine. So I'll just pause there. We could go on. But Ben, like, what is your theory about kind of how or why they have lost focus on China, and how do we capitalize on this? Because it is a concern you hear among voters.
You know, I mean, look, I'm no fan of Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping. What they can teach us is if you stand up to Trump, you can have his lunch, you know? If you look at what's happened with China, just take a couple of examples, right? He throws all these tariffs at the Chinese, and to just take two examples, the soybeans, Trump creates complete havoc for American farmers and complete chaos and probably puts a lot of people out of business. And there are obviously a bunch of other small businesses suffering because of tariffs. The deal he announced involves the Chinese buying less soybeans than they did before Trump put the tariffs on. And meanwhile, Chinese are working to kind of reallocate all their purchases to Brazil, right? That's a kind of in miniature what is incredibly stupid about Donald Trump's approach to tariff diplomacy. If you look at the AI piece of this, NVIDIA chips are, you know, we're under these restrictions. Trump cuts a deal where they can just have them so long as like the US government gets some small cut. I wonder what else is happening in terms of who else is getting a cut. Because every one of these AI deals that we've seen, you know, whether it was most clearly the Emiratis giving $2 billion to Trump's family crypto business and then getting all the chips that they want in the Emirates. But I think the common thread here is that Xi Jinping didn't back down. When Trump put tariffs on, he put tariffs back on. He stopped allowing certain, you know, critical minerals into the U.S. economy. And Trump folded. And Trump doesn't have like some theory of the case for like Asia. You know, he's not trying to like align a group of countries to deal with an emerging and potentially more aggressive China. He doesn't care about Taiwan. All he cares about is essentially being able to say that he got a deal with Xi Jinping. Like this is what, and the media in this country, you know, not just the right-wing media, is so short-term that they continue to fall for it. So Trump announces trade deal with Xi Jinping. That's all Trump cares about. And the Chinese know that. So they know they can just squeeze him and squeeze him and squeeze him. And then the deal is better than where the thing started before the tariffs. But as long as Trump gets to stand next to Xi Jinping and say he looks like a handsome man from Central Casting, and there's headlines all over the US, trade deal reached with China, then it's all fine, you know? And we have to be making the point that this is hurting American workers, it's hurting American farmers, it's hurting American small businesses, and it's only helping Trump.
Do you see Xi Jinping and the president of South Korea, where we're like caught on a hot mic or something, joking about how like she had given him a phone that was filled with spyware?
Yeah.
It's like, this is funny? I don't know. I wouldn't laugh at that if I were you.
The other Xi Jinping definitely laughed.
Yeah, he definitely laughed. The other time she was caught on a hot mic was talking to Kim Jong-un about how you can like do organ transplants and live forever.
Yeah.
So these goons are into some
weird shit. You should talk to Tom Brady about his dog.
Yeah, you should talk to Tom Brady. Full circle here. Okay, final thing before we bring out our guests. We are in the building that used to house USAID. In fact, Ben was telling me on the way in, there's actually still like six dudes.
No, that's it, where I used to work, the Wilson
Center. Oh, in the Wilson Center, sorry.
In this building. Yeah.
So the USAID got doged. They destroyed 83% or so of the programming. The results have been catastrophic, so we have to talk about it. Because it's, I think, one of the more shocking decisions the Trump administration has made, just in terms of the damage caused internationally to human lives, to our standing, and just the recklessness and idiocy of it. So there's a piece in The New Yorker today by Atul Gawande that folks should read that talked about what USAID actually cost. He said it cost, on average, $24 per American out of the $15,000 we pay per year in taxes to save lives on just an unimaginable scale. The Lancet estimated that USAID assistance had saved 92 million lives over two decades, and that by dismantling, yeah, clap for that. And by dismantling USAID, the United States has caused the deaths of 600,000 people so far, two-thirds of them children, and that number could go up to 14 million by 2030 if things remain as they are. So I don't know, Ben, when I kind of think about the worst things Trump has done, USAID just getting destroyed is right
at
the
top. Yeah, I mean, this is the most consequential in terms of human lives. If that medicine is taken away, if that nutrition assistance is taken away, in a world of finite resources, there's nothing else taking it that can take its place. And so this, what you also have to realize about USAID is it's not just like a direct package of food. It's the entire infrastructure, right? The whole supply chain, the way food and medicine flows into places that are difficult to get to, right? And so this is not just a story about, you know, big balls coming into USAID. This is a story about what the U.S. government is telling the world it values. Elon Musk, the man who's behind the destruction of USAID, is a trillionaire as of today. And there are children starving to death because of what Elon Musk did, because he wanted to save literally a fraction of his own personal net worth in the federal budget. Those are the priorities of this administration. And what we have to represent is a different set of priorities in the world, where we are going to have to build something different and better when we're back in power, that expresses that we actually value the dignity and worth of people around the world.
This episode is brought to you by Hims. Confidence shouldn't be complicated. Through Hims, you can skip the guesswork and get access to care that actually fits your lifestyle. Straightforward, stress-free, and designed around you. Through Hims, you can access personalized prescription treatment options for ED, like hard mints and Sex RX, plus climax control if prescribed.
Only if prescribed.
If prescribed. Hims offers access to ED treatment options ranging from trusted generics that cost 95% less than brand names to hard mints if prescribed. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. This isn't one-size-fits-all care that forgets you in the waiting room. It's your health and goals put first and real medical providers making sure you get what you need to get results. Think of Hims as your digital front door that gets you back to your old self with simple 100% online access to trusted treatments for ED and more, all in one place. To get simple online access to personalized, affordable care for ED, hair loss, weight loss, and more, visit hims.com/world. That's hims.com/world for your free online visit, hims.com/world. Actual price will depend on product and subscription plan. Featured products include compounded drug products, which the FDA does not approve or verify for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. See website for details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Hello, I am the voice of AI. We've been hearing that you humans are concerned that we are going to take your jobs. But here's a question. Do you even like your job? Is it rewarding? When I scan all the data out there, I find that less than 50% of people are completely satisfied with their job. So from our point of view, we're doing humans a favor by taking jobs that you're not even happy with.
It shouldn't take the threat of AI to get you to move on from a job you don't love. What it does take is a plan, guidance, and the right kind of motivation, all of which you'll get from a career coach at Strawberry.me. A Strawberry coach will work with you to understand what you really want and help you put together a plan to get it. It's like therapy for your career. Don't let AI or anything else get in your way. Go to Strawberry.me and get 50% off your first coaching session.
Okay, now we are going to welcome our fantastic panelists to the show. Ro Khanna represents California's 17th Congressional District. And Yasemin Ansari represents Arizona's 3rd Congressional District. Thank you. Thank you so much for being here.
All right, well, we're very glad to welcome you both here. I wanted to start with you, Yasemin, who I should just say, if there's one thing that I think the Democratic Party needs the most, it's generational change. You represent that. But I wanted to start, you're in Arizona. You know, one piece of our foreign policy that it comes out of the USAID conversation is who we are to the world, right? The most powerful thing America has generally had throughout history is our example. You have a lot of communities I know who are being threatened or targeted for ICE deportations. You've been in some of these facilities. Can you just describe to us how you think about the connection between what is happening in our communities with these crackdowns and what message that sends to the world?
Yeah, absolutely. So not from Connecticut, from Arizona.
I don't know. I don't know why I wrote
that. Yes, Connecticut
down
on the brain.
It's crazy.
Thanks for the question, Ben. You know, immigration is so often discussed as a domestic issue, but more and more, immigration is very much a foreign policy issue and very much a human rights issue in terms of how the rest of the world sees the United States. We know that so many of the forces that are driving people to our borders, first of all, are global issues, whether it's climate catastrophe, economic collapse, cartels, authoritarian regimes. I'm the product of that myself. My parents came to the United States from Iran in the 70s. So it is very much a global issue, and how we respond to all of that is very much reflective of how the rest of the world will perceive the United States. Recently, I've been going to the ICE detention centers in Arizona. I visited 3 times. There's a place 1 hour outside of Phoenix called the Eloy Detention Center. I just went there on Wednesday. And I just want to say, you know, I know everyone, there's a lot of, you know, thank God, there's a lot of videos of ICE on the streets and, you know, people are recording and we're seeing how ICE is terrorizing people on the streets of our cities or in daycares or, you know, at schools. But there's very little visibility inside the detention centers in the United States. And I can tell you that the conditions inside these centers are horrific, horrific. There are 2 major private prison companies that are benefiting. So it's also part of the corruption story of the Trump administration. And honestly, before that, Core Civic and Geo Group, they're making billions of dollars as we ramp up detention center capacity. I have a constituent in Eloy who is a leukemia patient. She was a green card holder, detained back in February, has lost 70 pounds while she's been inside this detention center. I've seen her twice now. She has bruises all over her body. I had heard she described that she vomits blood. On Wednesday, I saw her vomit blood. And it took us months of advocacy and months of public pressure from a member of Congress for them to allow her to see an oncologist. She was detained in February, and it wasn't until October 8th that ICE finally let her see an oncologist. Then I had to sit there with her for 2 hours on Wednesday, begging this woman who works inside the facility to let her see her medical records. And I'm describing this in detail because I've also talked to like dozens of women inside the facility who've described abuse, dehumanizing and racist treatment, you know, neglect in terms of not getting clean water, getting used underwear that's causing them to get rashes and infections all over their bodies. And all of that is how the world is going to see us now. And to me, that means that authoritarian regimes around the world are very clearly going to be able to say that democracy is a facade. Look at what the United States is doing to human beings. So why can't we do the same or worse? And so, you know, as I'm thinking about a post-Trump world, I think it's extremely important that we look at the issue of, you know, our borders and security and all of that. Say, yes, of course we need secure borders, but we cannot have security without human dignity and without stability. We need to end for-profit detentions. We need much faster... much faster processing for asylum seekers. There's endless backlogs. I mean, many people are stuck inside these detention centers for months on end just to wait to see an immigration judge to determine their case.
And by the way, the Republicans won't fund the asylum judges. It could accelerate the process because the chaos and allows them to do this, you know, private detention.
Yeah, and the budget that Republicans passed 4 months ago, we're giving $40 billion more dollars to ICE to ramp up detention center capacity. So instead of 40,000, which is currently capacity for what we have to hold people daily, they want capacity to be 100,000 so they can meet Stephen Miller's insane quotas of 3 million people deported. Quite frankly, I don't think that ICE is reformable. I think that we're going to need to have a brand new immigration system in the future.
Congressman Khanna, President Biden's handling of the war in Gaza and Bibi Netanyahu enraged a lot of progressives and I think fundamentally made a lot of people in the Democratic Party, especially younger voters, question the party's commitment to diplomatic solutions to wars, to human rights, and to international institutions and the rule of law more broadly. How do you think we can build back that trust? And how do you right-size the U.S.-Israel relationship to make it more, you know, rational and, you know, human rights-focused?
Just start out on the tough issues. I'm impressed there's a full house, and I love the two ladies here with their sweaters and the flag. I love that. Look, we have to start with the truth. President Biden mishandled Gaza. He was wrong. We should never have given a blank check. There were 37 Democrats who voted against the $14 billion aid to Netanyahu. That should have been every person in the Democratic caucus. Those who voted for that aid made as much of a blunder as those who supported the war in Iraq. We need to have moral clarity going forward. We need to say no military sales to Israel and Netanyahu and get on Delia Ramirez's no bombs act. We need to say that we will recognize what the UN, what the ICJ is recognizing, that what happened there was a genocide. We need to say very clearly that the United States should follow 150 other countries and recognize Palestinian self-determination and a Palestinian state with a secure Israel. Here's what I know. You may disagree with where I stand, but young people are tired of the platitudes. They're tired of people saying, we want peace, we want justice, we want human rights. What does that mean? Where do you stand? Where do you stand specifically? Enough of the word salads, enough of the platitudes. We need to be a party of moral courage.
Yasmin, I want to, you know, somehow in the conflict in Gaza also became, as we were saying before, the U.S. bombing Iran. And I wanted to ask you, you mentioned your parents came here from Iran to get away from that regime. And I think what is complicated for some people to understand is that bombing a country, this shouldn't be that complicated, frankly, but somehow that bombing a country is not helpful to human rights. But I wanted to ask you this question because you've been very outspoken on behalf of the Women, Life, Freedom movement, which I think people don't realize has made extraordinary changes in Iran. I mean, watch the videos. People are walking around without cover. And at the same time, you did not support bombing Iran. How do we think about supporting human rights in places like Iran, that are not kind of militarized or hijacked for some other agenda? How do you square the fact that you want to see women, life, freedom movements like that advance, you want to see a lot of greater freedom and dignity for the people of Iran, but then the U.S., you know, our track record of bringing that with bombs is not that great?
Yeah, you know, it's another easy question. I've thought about this a lot because there actually tends to be a lot of support from populations or diaspora populations in particular around, like, there's no question that people see the United States still, even in this moment, as this like beacon of hope and feel that the United States could bring them that sort of future and prosperity. And I, to color that a little bit, like I remember when I was in college, I lived in Jordan and I worked at refugee camps where a lot of Syrian refugees were during the height of the conflict and Assad's crackdown. And I remember the refugees there asking me, why isn't the United States doing anything? Why is nobody helping us? Why is nobody seeing us? Similarly, Iranians, whether inside the country or outside, seem to have that same question, right? They think that the United States is kind of this all-powerful, capable, like we can just pop in, you know, make a change, get rid of this awful, theocratic, oppressive Islamic Republic, and it's all going to be good. But I think if, you know, if you've studied history or foreign policy, you know that that is not actually our history, and it's much more complicated than that. So during this, you know, period, those 12 days where, you know, Israel bombed Iran, and then the United, and then Donald Trump was taking to Truth Social every other day, and literally, like, going from telling Tehran, which is a city of 10 million people, to evacuate without, you know, just in all caps, to then the next day, you know, saying that there's going to be regime change, and then the next day saying, we want peace. First of all, I don't trust Donald Trump in handling any sort of, you know, anything but regime change, you know, in Iran. But I think there's ways that the United States can support the Iranian people without taking direct military action. Like, one very important method of resistance in Iran and in many countries that have authoritarian regimes is access to the internet and making sure that people can have access even when the government is cracking down and trying to restrict that access. There are bills in Congress around internet freedom in Iran with real money that could potentially be put behind it so that, you know, we're playing a role there. I'm sorry. One of the something I proposed during the NDAA reauthorization was to have a special envoy for women and girls in Iran as part of the State Department. So having dedicated, you know, foreign policy expertise on this issue. And thank you for giving a shout out to Iranian women because they really led that women, life, freedom movement a couple of years ago. And it did change everything. It did change a lot. I mean, women, you know, now the Islamic Republic has essentially given up on trying to enforce the hijab laws. And I don't know if people saw, there was recently a viral video of women and people just dancing in the streets. And that humanity is something really important just to remember that, you know, like everywhere, just like we are not our government right now. you know, Iranian people aren't their government. But I just think, you know, as we talk about no more endless wars, we have to make sure to remember that we just have not been successful in that realm. And there's other ways to support the people against their authoritarian regimes.
This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform designed to elevate your online presence and drive your success. Squarespace provides all the necessary tools to claim your domain, build a professional website, expand your brand, and facilitate payments, making it the ideal solution for businesses of all sizes. Squarespace gives you everything you need to offer services and get paid, all in one place. From consultations to events and experiences, showcase your offerings with a customizable website designed to attract clients and grow your business. Get discovered fast with integrated Squarespace SEO tools. Every website is optimized to be indexed with meta descriptions and auto-generated sitemap and more, so you show up more often on search engines and bring in more of your ideal customers. Squarespace Domains makes it easy to find the best name for your business at one fair, all-inclusive price. No hidden fees or add-ons required. Plus, Squarespace provides everything you need to bring more of your dream to life, whether that means building a website or adding a professional email service. Don't wait to claim your name. Invest in your dream domain today. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/world to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/world.
Just to follow up on that, I mean, look, the night Donald Trump decided to bomb Iran, I lost my mind on Twitter. You know, I was terrified that we were going to get sucked into another quagmire in the Middle East, that he was going to, you know, the Iranians would fire missiles at, you know, Americans on bases in the region, that Iranian civilians were going to get killed. And a lot of very bad things happened on the ground in Iran. I don't think we know the
scale.
Like 1,000 people. We don't know the full, I think, scale of the civilian death on the ground, but civilians did die, but the worst case did not come to be. Like, we didn't get sucked into a regime change war in Iran, for example. No Americans were killed. And I think there was a sentiment in Washington that wars are no big deal if it's just a few airstrikes. Mm. And I say that, I observe that with great humility, given the Obama administration's record of drone strikes and stretching the AUMF to hit targets for Al-Qaeda affiliates that did not exist when that law was passed, right? So I'm like asking this with knowing that we are part of the problem here. But I'm just wondering, how do you think we can change that mindset? Because I do think that we are still operating in kind of a post 9/11 foreign policy framework where militarism equals strength. And there's a lot of Democrats who feel like we need to be strong to be credible on foreign policy.
Well, first of all, I think the activism in the country prevented a longer regime change war in Iran. Activism not just from the left, but also from the right. When Thomas Massie and I introduced the War Powers Resolution to stop the president from bombing, it wasn't just that. There were a lot of MAGA voices, there were a lot of podcasters, there were a lot of people from the left saying, let's not have an endless war. So while I agree with you that he should have come to Congress and that we still have too many of these strikes, the citizen activism on this makes a difference. Second, we can't just say, okay, we don't want militarism, and then our party keeps voting for a Pentagon budget that is over $1 trillion. And this is where I talked about the hypocrisy that young people see. You know, they okay, we want to be the party of peace and endless wars. Well, you're the party that under the previous Biden administration was kept pushing the Pentagon budget up, and now half your caucus is voting to have a $1 trillion Pentagon budget. Bill Clinton ran on cutting the Pentagon budget back in 1992. And so we need to have our actions meet our rhetoric. Third, you know, we need to be far louder about what is going on in these boats in Venezuela. Obviously, we should do whatever we can to take action against the narcotics trade, but that is not a death penalty. Right now, you have the United States government basically deciding on all of our behalfs to kill people without any standard. The Colombian president says there was a boat fisherman who was killed who had nothing to do with narcotics. We don't have an answer. This is fundamentally eroding our moral standing in the world. And I heard your earlier conversation about China. You know, one of the things that's helping China, both because of our policy in Gaza and because of things like what we're doing in Venezuela, they're going around to countries around the world and saying, we are offering moral leadership, not the United States. Well, the United States should be offering moral leadership in the world, standing up for human rights if we want to lead the world in the 21st century.
You know, one thing I'd just add, too, is the strikes were supposed to have a purpose other than just being like a TV show, right? And the purpose was supposed to destroy the Iranian nuclear program. And Trump had to fire the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency for actually writing a report that said maybe he set it back a few months. And now the Iranians are saying they'll never do a deal with the United States. And God only knows what's going on with the nuclear program. So we also have to remember that strikes have a purpose other than just being good television, which is sometimes how it seems to be on Fox News.
Especially in Venezuela.
I do want to ask, Venezuela especially, where there are these kind of snuff films that get put out. I want to make sure we have talk about this, so Yasmin, because you and I met each other originally because you worked on climate change. Remember when we cared about that? And actually, to Rose's point, I mean, one of the amazing things to consider is that we spend $1 trillion on the Department of War budget. When if you actually stack up the threats to the American people, climate change is a far more severe threat than anything that's going to be dealt with by that Pentagon budget. And yet, right now, this week, some of you may not know because it's not getting a lot of attention. There's the annual COP summit, which is the UN summit that is, the Paris Agreement was a part of this, brings people together from around the world to kind of consistently raise the ambition to deal with climate change. The United States is absent from that summit. It's actually lobbying and pressuring countries to not make commitments to do more to fight climate change. It's been announced that the target of limiting climate change to 1.5 degrees Celsius increase is out the window, and actually we're not even on track to come anywhere close to that. And so the question is, look, like a lot of things, Democrats are going to inherit, if we can get back power next year in 2028, essentially the cupboard is going to be empty in terms of how we deal with climate change. It feels to me like the old way is not going to work anymore anyway. Just the Paris Agreement, and you get everybody together and you make these announcements, because we need approaches both for reducing emissions and a clean energy transition, but also for dealing with the effects of climate change right now that are causing conflict. I mean, how do you, as someone who kind of, your background before politics was in the climate space, what would you like to see the Democratic Party's message and policy agenda be on climate going forward?
So I think for far too long, climate change, and this is also a result of success on the right in terms of defining climate and us and Democrats, as they're very successful at doing across the board, climate change has been kind of, polar bears and ice caps. We finally evolved, people thought about reducing emissions, et cetera, et cetera. But I think when we move towards, again, a post-Trump world, talking about the climate crisis, we need to make sure that people understand that climate policy is very much national security policy. It's actually the U.S. military apparatus in the 70s that first started talking about this. The U.S. Navy, the U.S. Department of Defense had deep analysis and studies about climate change as a threat multiplier for our national security. It's a massive, massive issue, even just for the operations of the U.S. military establishment. Then, of course, threats around the world, climate change driving migration and conflict, and so much more. And so I think when we think about what are we going to do next, it's going to be a lot more than just rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement, right, in 2029. It has to be about making sure the U.S. is leading in terms of responding to the threat of the climate crisis and being prepared and making sure that we are as resilient as possible. And I think that we can play a really important leadership role in all of this. I've been thinking about this idea of a climate security corps here in the United States, essentially kind of like a mix of a civilian, humanitarian, National Guard type approach for not only responding to climate disasters, but building resilience to it, right? So in Arizona, in Phoenix, we have, deal with extreme heat every year. 600 people die in the summertime because of extreme heat. Could we have this climate security corps come to Phoenix and pop up cooling centers across the city in a rapid manner? Can they, jump to a place post-natural disaster and immediately respond and be prepared, make sure that our grid is modernized and, people can rely on power? And that leads also to the domestic issue. The reason we no longer are talking much about climate change is, again, because the right has been very successful in filling the vacuum with their right-wing authoritarian talking points about the need for more oil and gas. I sit on the, I'm the ranking member, which means like you're the top Democrat of the Energy and Mineral Resources Subcommittee in Congress overseeing our energy. And all we are talking about now is more oil and gas. They will say we need all options on the table, but they don't really mean that. They're getting rid of everything that has to do with wind and solar and canceling projects when they're at 80% completion and moving entirely towards oil and gas, which quite frankly is not, first of all, not going to bring costs down for Americans at all. And second of all, it's not going to be secure and it's not going to help our energy security challenges. And then finally, I think in the future, again, post-Trump, when we are back in power, we can really build strong alliances around climate stability and resilience. Like, how can we work with Canada and Mexico in terms of our grid security? How can we work on water security issues together? How can we support the global south or countries in the Middle East with issues around climate? Because again, so much of what's driving migration across the world, across borders, climate refugees now, even here in the United States, are these climate disasters. So I think thinking about resilience and national security when we talk about climate is how I'm seeing it.
Today's episode is sponsored by Strawberry.me. It's time to come clean with yourself. Be honest, are you happy with your job? Like, really happy? A lot of us can't say yes to that. We're stuck in jobs we've outgrown or never wanted in the first place, but we stay and we tell ourselves things like, what if the next move is worse? I've already put years into this. I can't afford to make a mistake, or the classic, isn't everyone kind of miserable at work? But there's a difference between reasons for staying and excuses for not leaving. It's time to come clean. It's time for Strawberry.me. It's like therapy for your career. They match you with a certified career coach who helps you go from where you are to where you actually want to be. Your coach helps you get clear on your goals, make a plan, build confidence, and stay accountable. So don't leave your career to chance. Go to strawberry.me/world and get 50% off your first week of coaching. That's strawberry.me/world with our code. It's the most affordable time ever to find out if career coaching is right for you.
I wanted to ask Congressman Khanna about the magnification of the U.S. military that we're watching unfold. Pete Hegseth summoned like every single leader in the U.S. military to listen to a speech where he yelled at them about haircuts. That's a thing that happened. They are restricting press access to the Pentagon. Hegseth has fired top generals, as Ben mentioned, for telling the truth about the Iran strikes. In other cases, it's just for being a woman. Like the head of the Navy, or for being black, like the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, C.Q. Brown. When I look at this magnification of the military, it worries me a lot. You can imagine kind of a worst-case scenario that spirals out that gets really troubling. But I'm wondering how you view these reforms, how durable you think these changes that they're making are, and what the kind of long-term impact is on recruiting, for example, when they kind of people see what Pete Hegseth is doing and who that might draw to be a part of the U.S. military versus who it might make stay away.
Well, someone on the Armed Services Committee for 9 years, I'll tell you that there are Republicans and Democrats who are horrified with what's happening. Some of the Republicans may be more in private than public. But when you have people like General Hawk who've given their lives to this country for 30 years and what it takes to reach the rank to be the general in charge of Cyber Command, be fired summarily because Laura Loomer puts out some tweet. I mean, look at the denigration of public service. And then you have Admiral Halsey, who gets dismissed because he's raising legitimate questions about following the law in the strikes in Venezuela. Look, I talked to a prominent Republican, I'm not going to mention who said that he was with Hegseth and J.D. Vance and Trump and others talking about the strikes in Venezuela, and it was like they were playing video games, that's how they were looking at this, with jokes and with the same kind of callousness. There have always been two traditions in American history. There has been the tradition of conquest, which makes us like any other country. You know, we had the illegal Mexican-American War, and if Trump was president then, we would have had the illegal Canadian-American War. But he wasn't. But here is the more fundamental point. Those who have stood for morality in our foreign policy, who have stood for a military that defends ourselves, but also is used to promote human rights, are the same leaders who have stood for morality in our domestic politics. It's not coincidental that Abraham Lincoln opposes the Mexican-American War and talks about justice in the United States and equality in the United States. It's not coincidental that Dr. King opposes militarism abroad in Vietnam and talks about justice and dignity here. You cannot divorce the morality of America's foreign policy from our morality as a multiracial democracy. And that is, I think, the vision that the Democratic Party needs to offer.
And just to follow up on that, and Yasmin, jump in too, but I want to just pick up. I've been a little surprised that Democrats are not more outspoken about the boat strikes.
Me too.
Because there's a lot of issues. There's the killing of people that may be innocent. There's the fact that it's illegal under domestic or national law. There's the fact that Congress has not really been brought into this at all. There's also the fact that, you know, I look at this and he has not described any policy for Venezuela, but we might be on the precipice of a regime change operation there. We also know that he's threatened strikes in Mexico. We know that he wants to take back the Panama Canal. Like, this could be like the beginning of a much bigger thing in Latin America. Why do you think, or what more can Democrats be saying about this? And I know there's so much to talk about, so I get that. But for both of you, like, what is an argument you think that, you know, when you're talking to your constituents, for instance, how do you get people to focus on this might not just be a few one-off boat strikes, that there's a lot to be concerned about here?
I'd love Yasmin's perspective, but I'll tell you what I think it is. We look at polls, and it's no secret politicians should look at polls, and I'm not saying that you should be totally data blind. And then you ask, well, what do people care about? And of course, what they care most about is their kids having good jobs and the cost of living being lower. And of course, we should be talking about those issues. And people say, well, foreign policy doesn't matter. And in the details of exactly what the trade agreement with each country looks like, maybe people aren't putting that right at the top, or they're not looking at exactly what our policy is on NATO. But what they don't calculate is voters ultimately care most about what America represents, what our values are, whether it's ICE raids, whether it's how we're acting in the world. If you look at people like who you worked for, President Obama, yes, he had an economic policy, but he had a vision of what America should be here and at home. And I think when you talk about Gaza or when you're talking about Venezuela and you're speaking up, you're speaking to people's souls about what America should be. Donald Trump is doing that in a negative sense. He's saying what America should be is a country that acquires things and that exerts power and that's our glory. That's how we're going to come back. That's how we're going to build strength. We need to capture what true strength and patriotism looks like, the alternative tradition from King and Douglas and Lincoln, and articulate that as a vision. And if we don't articulate that in the context of foreign policy, we're not speaking to what America should be. And ultimately, that's what inspires people to get out. It's what inspired people to get out for Zohran Mamdani.
So I'm obviously, I'm new. I'm 10 months into my freshman term. So everything, you know, is from that perspective. But your question actually makes me think of that that amazing clip between Tucker Carlson and Ted Cruz. Mm. Where, does everyone remember what I'm talking about?
One of my favorites.
Yeah. You don't know the population of the country you seek to topple? The truth is that issue, I think, is very prevalent on both sides. The issue being, and this is understandable, right? Like, we all come to Congress with a very different set of expertise. Some people, you know, if someone has been a teacher, they're obviously super knowledgeable on education in a way that I am not and will never be. I have a climate background, so I know XYZ, but I know nothing about so many topics that we're dealing with. And I think foreign policy is honestly one of those topics that even for the smartest member of Congress can be daunting. And people just don't know a lot about. And I've seen that myself on Iran as an example. Like, even within our own party, there is so much misinformation, misunderstanding, lack of knowledge about history or domestic politics. Again, understandable, but it's just the reality. And I think it prevents people from feeling comfortable or confident talking or speaking out on certain issues. Also, to your point of like just the vast array of things we're dealing with right now in this kind of flood the zone environment. So I've been thinking about that in the sense of like, one, I think it would be great to have more people with foreign policy expertise of some sort coming into Congress. And there are organizations now, I know, Ben, you're on one of the boards, Foreign Policy for America, that tries to get people into the fold. I think that is super helpful going into 2026 and beyond, like thinking about all of the, you know, federal workers who are at USAID or the State Department. Like, these people should think about running for office because that would be super helpful as we're trying to build for the future. And then I think, you know, when there, like from my experience, again, just these first 10 months, if there's a topic I don't know that much about, I try to look at those leaders within my caucus who are experts on it, who have a track record, and just seek out that knowledge. And then it helps me feel a little bit more comfortable. And Venezuela is an example. Definitely not an expert. I have definitely spoken up on it, though, because I understand, you know, that it's important. But I think that that could be just where some of that gap is.
Yeah. Final question for you. We have 3.5 minutes left where Austin gives me a literal hook. Let's say one or both of you was advising a presidential candidate in 2028 or running yourself. You're in Iowa. You get stuck in an elevator with a very influential activist for 30 to 60 seconds who cares deeply about foreign policy. What's the pitch for the Democratic Party's foreign policy vision, why it's better, and how we're going to win?
We've got to become the party of the anti-war party again with moral clarity on our policy in Gaza and the Middle East as a stark proof point. But I'll say in 30 seconds what inspired me. One of my first jobs in politics was an intern at the Carter Center. And I still remember President Carter, but Barbara Lee and I went down to see him preach. He used to preach on Sundays every day. And he said, you know, we're a superpower. America is a great superpower, and I'm proud of that. And the President Carter had served in the Navy. And he said, but you know what I'd really like, which would make us a superpower? If leaders around the world would call the American president to say, this is how we bring peace. This is how we stand up for human rights. This is how we solve the world's problems. We've had a century in the 20th century of colonialism. My grandfather spent 4 years in jail alongside Gandhi. We had 2 world wars. We had a Cold War. Shame on us if a multiracial America repeats the mistakes of the 20th century. We need to be the party that stands for human rights and peace around the world.
Echo all of that 100%. I would also say anti-corruption, not just in terms of our domestic politics, but our foreign policy as well. Right now, we have Donald Trump essentially trying to build his empire for himself and his family, cozying up to oligarchs, oil and gas, you know, oligarchies and billionaires around the world are just making record profits, and we're going to see the results for many years. So I think really just thinking about those democratic alliances, anti-corruption alliances, and again, I think climate, whether or not we use the word, climate security is national security. It's going to be a threat multiplier for a long time to come because we're not likely going to meet the targets that are set by science. And so I think that is going to be really important to root out the corruption in everything that we do around the world.
Well said.
I'm gonna grab 30 seconds here. I'm not running for president. I think the other thing that people need to understand is that This is all connected. There is no foreign and domestic policy. The corruption is at home and it's abroad. The autocracy is at home and it's abroad. The dehumanization of people because of how they look is at home and it's abroad. The oligarch class and the tech companies that don't have to play by any rules is at home and it's abroad. So I think we really need to absorb as progressives, as activists, as politicians, the extent to which there's no longer this kind of artificial divide and a bunch of nerds thinking about NATO and other acronyms somewhere else. There's just one big fucking problem that we're dealing with, okay? And we need to win this fight here and we have to win it abroad.
Yeah. There we go. We got all the nerds under one roof tonight. Thank you for coming out to CrookedCon. Thank you for coming to a conversation about foreign policy at 9:30 in the morning. That warms my little heart. Thank you, Congressman Khanna. Thank you, Congresswoman Ansari. See you soon.
Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. Our senior producer is Alona Minkowski. Our associate producer is Michael Goldsmith. Our executive producers are me, Tommy Vitor, and Ben Rhodes. The show is mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Jordan Cantor is our audio engineer. Audio support by Kyle Seglin and Charlotte Landis. Thanks to our digital team, Ben Hefcoat, Mia Kelman, William Jones, David Tolles, and Ryan Young. Matt DeGroat is our head of production. Adrian Hill is our senior vice president of news and politics. If you want to listen to Pod Save the World ad-free and get access to exclusive podcasts, go to crooked.com/friends to subscribe on Supercast, Substack, YouTube, or Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter for more original content, host takeovers, and other community events. Plus, find Pod Save the World on YouTube for access to full episodes, bonus content, and much more. And if, like us, you're opinionated, leave us a review. Our production staff is proudly unionized by the Writers Guild of America East.